This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. The air quality of the Puget Sound region is improving for now, but the smoky skies are still lingering from fires in British Columbia. A map of BC is dotted from north to south with 500 wildfires. And yesterday, the British Columbia government declared a province-wide state of emergency in response to the ongoing wildfires. So how much longer will this go on? Joining us, Ian Bailey, a reporter for The Globe and Mail in Vancouver. He's been following the wildfire situation. Also with us, Eric Saganich with the Puget Sound Clear Air Agency. Thanks very much to both of you for joining us.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Hey, Ian, I wanted to start with you. Your story suggested that at this point, firefighters in British Columbia can do little more than wait for rain. Is that in the forecast?
There's not much rain in the forecast. Indeed, there's none of the kind of province-wide rain that fire officials are saying they need to get some traction on dealing with what's shaping up as a really challenging forest fire or wildfire season. So no, there's nothing. I've been in touch with officials this morning, and no, there's nothing in the forecast that would provide that kind of assistance.
Ian, the air quality here has been worse than Beijing, but what's the air quality like in Vancouver? You're much closer to these wildfires.
Well, there have been sort of alerts out to sort of warn those who might be vulnerable to bad air, you know, the elderly, those with medical conditions, parents with young children, obviously, of the quality. But, I mean, you know, the mountains, shall we say, in Vancouver, which normally loom over the north side of the city, are obscured by smoke, but it's not as bad as it's been in past years. There's been the smell of smoke in the city and that kind of thing, but it's not there yet. But certainly there are concerns about particulate matter that's coming from these hundreds of fires burning across the province, many of them very far from Vancouver.
Have there been any fatalities associated with the British Columbia wildfires?
No, there have been no reported fatalities due to health concerns, and nor any reported fatalities due to forest fire, men and women working on the ground to deal with the forest fires.
And how about homes and buildings? Have many of them been reported destroyed because of the wildfires?
I haven't seen any report, and there have been many reports summing up that damage to homes and residences. In a conference call yesterday with a pair of cabinet ministers and wildfire officials, they said the emphasis certainly has been on protecting people and protecting property so far in terms of dealing with these forest fires.
What does this declaration of emergency mean in practical terms for what British Columbia can do to fight the fires?
Basically, it's a term that allows very sort of the deployment of resources. It empowers forest fire officials and police and others to sort of impose orders, to sort of manage members of the public, and to sort of get things going in terms of dealing with fighting the forest fire. It also streamlines the ability to deploy funds, resources, and other assets to deal with the forest fires.
How does this wildfire season compare to years past, Ian?
So far, according to some numbers, this is ranking as, at this point, with a month sort of officially to go, as the fourth largest wildfire season in British Columbia since 1950. There was a helpful comparison yesterday in a major briefing on this matter. Last year, we had a number of massive major fires earlier on in the summer. The challenge this year is we have many, many more fires burning in many, many more areas. So it's a kind of a different thing, and substantially fewer evacuations, but still clearly a number of concerns. To put that in numbers, as of Wednesday, there were 566 recorded wildfires in British Columbia, compared last year at this time with 150 in total.
Wow, five times is more than last year.
Exactly.
Ian Bailey's
with us.
But
they aren't as large as they were last year.
Yeah. Ian Bailey's with us. He's a reporter for The Globe and Mail in Vancouver. Also with us, Eric Saganich with the Puget Sound Clear Air Agency. Eric, what is the smoke coming south, and what's in it, and what's it doing to us?
Yeah, so in smoke, we have a number of different types of chemicals when you burn anything. And one thing we really are most concerned about are called the fine particles. And these are really, really small, and they can essentially reach the deepest part of your lungs.
Now, is it affecting everybody, or is it if you don't have some kind of respiratory issues, are you pretty much not going to be affected by this?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of individuals that may not recognize they have a heart condition yet, or, you know, their symptoms haven't shown up, but having wildfire smoke and at these kind of concentrations can actually, you know, elevate their risk to triggering an event like that. So we generally make the message that even, you know, for healthy adults, that just take care when the levels are unhealthy. Thankfully, we're starting to see the levels actually taper off quite a bit right now, and levels are starting to reach moderate throughout most of Puget Sound. The levels are still hanging there. We expect that to continue through most of the day. But if you're still up in the Cascade foothills nestled in there, we're still seeing levels that are unhealthy for sensitive groups at this point.
Well, that's good to hear, because you look outside and it looks just as hazy, if not hazier, than it has in the past days when apparently the air quality was worse.
Right, and we do have a lot of upper-level smoke still, and we're going to see a lot of that continue, actually. So it's going to be, you know, hard for folks to even assess sometimes what their air quality is unless you look at some of the air monitoring data and look at our website, because, you know, we're going to see now more smoke from California, Oregon now coming as the winds have changed, and we'll be seeing that pattern potentially for a couple more days. So we still say interesting sunsets, but we still expect on the ground level some of our air quality to be good or moderate.
So it might stop coming from the north, but it'll start coming from the south, this smoke?
Right. And then we're getting more concerned about potentially even Sunday or Monday, where the pattern shifts again and the high pressure comes and we're going to see more smoke from British Columbia. And we're actually more concerned about that with that pattern, because that's where the smoke gets pushed down and south, and just the sheer massive amounts of smoke from British Columbia. I mean, this is pretty unique, and I think it's already been highlighted how significant this amount of smoke is. And so we could see this return as early as next week. It's still pretty iffy on the models. There's a lot of uncertainty, but we're watching it very closely.
It seems like there's uncertainty. I seem to hear every couple of days, oh, it's clearing up, but it doesn't seem to clear up.
Right, and there's a lot of complications with modeling smoke. I mean, there's just, you know, you have the whole column up kilometers up into the sky. You're trying to capture what's exactly going on, and all we're really looking at is focus on the ground level, and that's the only way we can actually prove if our models are working is what we have on the ground. But there's a lot of uncertainty on what's above us and how the fires are behaving and what's the actual fuels that they're burning from, and so it gets really tricky.
Final question for you, Ian Bailey, with the Globe and Mail. Yeah. You mentioned we've got about a month more, supposedly a month more, of the wildfire season in British Columbia. Does the wildfire season really mean anything anymore? Does it stop and end, or is it getting more open-ended?
That's an excellent question. We were asking yesterday about that, and it's at a certain point, I guess, you know, the climate changes, and it certainly brings a curtain down on it. What we heard from one of our senior ministers here in BC yesterday is that climate change is sort of making this kind of crisis each summer a kind of new normal: rising temperatures, drier forest.
Ian, thanks so much for your time. Ian Bailey, reporter for the Globe and Mail. And thanks to you, Eric Saganich, with the Puget Sound Clean Air Agency. It's The Record on KUOW. Sound stories, sound voices. Up ahead, a modular solution to our housing affordability crisis. The root cause of our housing affordability crisis is how expensive it is to build housing in Seattle. And there are two reasons it's expensive to build here. One is land prices. They've skyrocketed. And a second major reason that housing is so costly is that it's expensive to build. But what if you could cut the cost of building multifamily homes in half? That's the promise of modular housing. These are buildings constructed in factories, the electric, plumbing, counters, all built in. Then the modules are transported to the location and assembled on site. Well, the Compass Housing Alliance in Seattle has been trying to build lower-cost modular housing for several years now, and their story kind of tells the promise and also the challenges of modular building to try to create more affordable housing. Join us is Janet Pope, Executive Director of the Compass Housing Alliance. They've been around for about a century working on these issues. Thanks so much for stopping in.
Thank you. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk about all our investing in this solution.
Well, explain a little bit more on why it's cheaper to build modules in a factory than to build just from scratch on site, the way we see a lot of buildings done. Why is it cheaper?
Because the costs are contained and because you can design it all in advance and get it all permitted all in advance. So that definitely speeds up the time, as well as in our case, we're designing it for the population we serve, which is folks below the area median income, 50% of that, as well as homeless individuals. So we're able to put things specifically into the design and have it all manufactured that way and ready to go.
The first time I heard about the promise of modular housing was from you, like over 2 years ago. Compass Housing Alliance was presenting, and you were talking about this as being game-changing, the ability to lower the cost of construction. You were working on a modular housing village for Seattle's Columbia City neighborhood. You said it was much less expensive, and you were expecting it to open in 2017. What happened?
Right. So we've been in this space for over 3 years now, and just really seeing it, looking for what is a solution if we need to get to nearly 20,000 units of affordable housing based on the HALA report that the city prepared. And knowing that us combined with all the other developers, we may be building 500 units a year. So knowing that we were never going to get there, we had done some research and realized that steel modular construction is used around the world. And why isn't it done here? And so we had the land in Columbia City that we own and was slated for a permanent project down the road. And at the time, we were really thinking this could be a temporary solution as well as a permanent solution. So this land, we tried to do the temporary pilot and really create a playbook, mm-hmm. knowing that we really needed to get the policymakers out there to see it, touch it, feel it, and demonstrate success. And one of the key facts of that is we were really looking at these units could be craned in and craned off, so thinking that they could go anywhere that land was needed. We learned a lot. One of the things we learned that the temporary solution is not really effective, mm-hmm. just because you can't keep the cost down, because all the same costs for a permanent project also go into a temporary project.
So you've kind of backed off on Columbia City, but you're taking this idea to Edmonds. Tell us what you're doing there.
Absolutely. We have a wonderful partnership with Edmonds Lutheran Church, and we are really happy that a new partner has come along in the manufacturing of Blockable, and they're manufactured in Washington State, which allows us to work with them directly and control a lot of costs in their manufacturing plant. And so the church was very gracious in allowing us to use a chunk of land next to the land that we are about to purchase, where we plan a 70-unit development, and we've put a demonstration unit out there. So mm-hmm. we are now have proven that we can do this in a third of the time and around half the cost for the full unit.
Half the cost. So it'll cost half as much for you to use this modular housing for that unit than it would have cost if you built it on site.
Absolutely. We were able to put this one unit in 3 hours, and it was built in 6 weeks.
It's such a compelling argument for the use of this modular housing, but no one in Seattle is doing it. Why not?
Well, I don't know, because I really think we need to really search for that solution between the $25 million house and the $2,500 tiny house that's temporary. Our model is very much based on wraparound services and walking holistically alongside the people we serve. So trying to put our innovation around the service model that we've developed for 100 years and the community development model that we know we need beautiful, efficient buildings. There had to be something. And so looking around the world, this is used in Australia, in Europe, in Asia, and why it's not done here is just kind of a conundrum.
You know, I hear a lot of complaints from builders about the building codes here, about the processing of getting permits is extremely restrictive and difficult and takes much longer than they think it should. Does that come into play when it comes to this new kind of housing that you're talking about, modular? Is it extra difficult to get those kind of projects through in Seattle because of a regulatory morass that already exists?
Absolutely. And so that's some of the learning and the demonstration that we're trying to do here is that not is this just a pretty box for people to live in, but we have a crisis here. So what are some of the regulatory pieces that we can expedite? And I do believe that it's us pushing on this issue that have caused people to step back and look at it a little bit. And now we have an actual unit that we've been able to take elected officials through and other policymakers through, as well as different kind of financing and funding. And it was, I'll be honest, a little bit easier working in a smaller municipality where
in Edmonds,
get the,
rather than
they
Seattle.
Are so invested in being part of the solution.
Sure.
And so how can we reduce the permitting time and whatever the utilities connections and those kind of things?
You mentioned you learned a lot from trying to do this in Seattle and Columbia City. If there are one or two things that you think could change in Seattle that would make these modular housing solutions more easier to do, what would they be?
There's a lot of conversations we're involved in right now about using public lands for affordable housing, and there's been some real movement there. Some of the newer members on the City Council, Teresa Mosqueda, a new state law now that public lands should be given to affordable housing first. And again, a lot of those sites are not conducive to traditional built housing, but they're very conducive to modular villages. So looking that that can happen moving forward is something we're really excited about.
And of course, you've got to have land to build something, so you've got the land, but is there anything the city could be doing but isn't doing when it comes to actually putting in modular housing development there? Are there things with permitting, et cetera, that need to change in order to make it more able as a housing place to put these in?
Absolutely. So expediting the permitting, lowering the cost for the permitting when you're already a nonprofit developer, and some of those delays that happen in the permitting process just increase the cost. Every time you have to have an architect or somebody redesign something because a permit has changed, that increases the cost. Now, again, with modular, it's all approved before it ever even gets to the site. So getting folks to wrap their heads around that, and I do believe people are listening. There really aren't a lot of other solutions out there. And so I think people are starting to buy in finally.
Well, in this Edmonds project, if it goes as well as you say you expect it to go, should also be a demonstration for folks here
Absolutely.
In Seattle.
I'm totally convinced that until people come out there and see it and touch it and walk through it and see how operationally efficient it is. So it's a very green building, which means lower cost to operate, which in the Compass world means we have more money to invest in the services that we value really highly for the supports for our residents.
You've mentioned beauty a couple times. We might associate modular housing with trailers, with that kind of housing. It's not considered very attractive. Is that an issue when it comes to using modular housing? Does it look nice?
Yes. I can't tell you how many times I've said these are not containers. These are individually manufactured. And yes, they are absolutely beautiful. And so if you think of a Lego system, and the blockable manufacturing system allows you to switch out the exterior so it blends beautifully in any neighborhood. You know, we have windows, we have decks, we have, beautiful finishings in there, and a lot of smart technology, too. So you have the smart home technology for efficiency.
And you mentioned Blockable. That's the name of the company. When you first were talking about this 2.5 years ago, you were talking to a Chinese company. Have these companies building modular housing come up since then?
Blockable is the only one I'm aware of in the United States. Again,
really?
It's done all around the world. So we're very fortunate that they are in our own state here. And of course, when you're utilizing a foreign manufacturer, it's only going to increase the costs and the regulatory pieces as well.
Janet Pope, thanks so much for stopping by and talking to us about this. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thanks.
Janet is executive director of the Compass Housing Alliance. They're working on a modular housing unit that will be taking place up in Edmonds, and they've been trying to do this here in Seattle. But as you've heard, there are some barriers to getting that done. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. This is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. This is The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Sound stories, sound voices. Immigrant family separations are still looming, and now the Trump administration is turning its attention to immigrants who are residing in the U.S. legally. A leaked draft document indicates that the Department of Homeland Security would authorize federal officials to deny legal permanent resident status, green cards, to legal immigrants if they use public benefits, things like food stamps, Medicaid, or housing vouchers, benefits that they are entitled to. The administration's plan is based on a century-old law that says that a person who is very likely to become, quote, primarily dependent, end quote, on government services cannot become a legal permanent resident. This would affect about 250,000 people in Washington state, according to a breakdown done by the nonpartisan Migration Policy Institute. I'm joined by Sarah Soumadi from One America, a refugee advocacy group, and we have on the line with us Alia Haq. She's Nutrition Services Supervisor with the International Community Health Services. Now, in justifying this policy, the Department of Homeland Security said more than half of all immigrant households use one or more welfare program. They said this is driving up the federal debt and deficit. It's unfairly taking benefits away from vulnerable U.S. citizens and communities. And Homeland Security concludes that non-citizen public benefit usage is deeply unfair to U.S. taxpayers. Sarah, what's your response to that?
One thing that they don't mention, unfortunately, is that native-born citizens are actually more likely to use benefits and are more likely to not be working while receiving those benefits than foreign-born people who are here legally in the United States.
So you don't see it as taking away from vulnerable U.S. citizens?
No, not at all. There have been a lot of studies that show that every dollar that's invested in something like food stamps actually generates almost $2 in economic activity because it enables people to work, they pay more taxes, they spend more money.
Alia Haq, Nutrition Services Supervisor with the International Community Health Services, she's with us on the line. Now, even though this policy isn't official, I understand that immigrants are already reacting to this proposed policy to revoke legal resident status from legal immigrants if they use these public benefits. What are you hearing?
So I'm having a lot of families actually come to us and asking us to remove them from this program. They do not want any benefits. And one dad actually said that he would like us to remove his name from the WIC program, which I represent, the Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program. And also all the medical and dental benefits the ICHS provides to, whoever walks into the doors of ICHS. And the reason he gave me was that he does not want something that happened to his friend in California happened to him as well. And I asked, what happened to your friend? He said, my friend was deported. And similarly, I've had other women, pregnant women, come and tell us to remove them from this program. Either because their immigration process is going on or that they are going to apply for citizenship.
And what impact will this have on the health of folks who are saying, I don't want this service because I'm afraid it's going to hurt my status?
Okay, so WIC program is basically, the WIC nutrition program is a preventive health program, health benefit program, which provides health benefits, addresses childhood obesity, anemia, iron deficiency, and other health indicators that could lead to more significant conditions as children mature into adults. So by encouraging participation and investing in WIC, the government is actually saving later costs to Medicaid, emergency health services, and the American taxpayer. So it's actually, a program that benefits the government in the long run. And by not enrolling in the WIC program, I fear these children are going to go out and be sick and unhealthy. The ER visits are going to go up, and I'm afraid the infant and maternal mortality can even go up later on because these pregnant women who are going to be scared to, access any health care are going to give birth to kids at home.
Yeah. And WIC, if you're not familiar with, is the Women, Infants, and Children Program.
Nutrition program.
And Alia, when people say that I want to withdraw from this program, what do you tell them?
Well, we try our best to tell them that, you know what, this hasn't become a law yet, and we try to ease the situation by telling them that if you have been on this program for some time, it's not going to be, you're not going to be punished retroactively. And then we are not going to give your information to anyone. And in fact, at ICHS, where I work, the International Community Health Services, has clearly, does not allow anyone to give any information to government folks that walk into our clinics, and we simply try our best to, make it easy for them, but there's only so much we can do.
So you can promise them that this will not be used retroactively against them? Is that a promise you can keep?
Yes, that we can say because that's the information we received from the National Link Association and others, that it's not going to affect them retroactively.
Yeah. Sarah Soumadi from One America, this is a proposal for a change in the public charge test. Could you explain what the public charge test is and what the current rule is?
Yeah, absolutely. The public charge test has been around actually since the 1880s. The idea was that Folks who wanted to immigrate to the United States had to prove that they weren't likely to become a ward of the state in the future. And that concept is still applied in immigration law today. In order to obtain permanent resident status, a green card, someone has to show the government that, through a variety of factors, that they are not likely to become primarily dependent on government assistance in the future. And the government can look at things like their age, their health, their income, assets, who are they supporting, who's supporting them, and their ability to work. And then it also has a few negative factors currently that make it more likely that someone could be deemed a public charge. And those are if the person has ever received cash benefits, direct income maintenance, or if they've been institutionalized for long-term care at the government's expense. So a nursing facility paid by Medicaid, for example.
But a lot of these cases we're talking about are not that kind of cash payment.
Exactly. So what the Trump administration is proposing to do now, based on a leaked draft proposal we saw in March, what they're proposing to do is drastically expand the list of public benefits that could be considered negative factors in the public charge test. So everything from food stamps, Medicaid, even subsidized health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, which everyone is required to have, as we know, or we pay a tax penalty, even things like claiming the earned income tax credit on one's taxes. Those are all the things that the Trump administration wants to add to the test to make them negative factors.
It's kind of a black box because it's a proposed rule, and even the Trump administration has said that it might change. But what about this idea that it could be retroactive? Do we know that it couldn't be retroactive? Do they know that they could say that, oh, if you were receiving these benefits a year or 2 years ago, then you're going to be denied this status?
So what we are basing all of our analysis on is the latest leaked draft of the proposal, which is a 236-page proposal leaked to the press in March. And in that, there were direct provisions saying that this would not be retroactive, that if the rule were to become final, people would have time to make changes, and that there would be a specific date by which you might be penalized if you were still receiving benefits. But no, we have seen nothing that would say it would be retroactive.
Now, I understand this also affects people who are using public benefits for kids who are U.S. citizens.
Yes, that's one of the most radical changes that we've seen proposed, is that a parent who is eligible to receive their green card, they're already here lawfully. Let's say their U.S. citizen child is receiving subsidized health insurance or Medicaid, that parent could be penalized when they seek a green card based on that.
Alia, I understand one of the stories that you've heard from a WIC-enrolled woman was that she was leaving the country. Could you tell us that story?
Yes, that was a heartbreaking story because the dad and the grandfather came with this little baby, hardly two months old, and another child. And they were having difficulty feeding this kid. And as we had seen the mother earlier, we asked them, you know, the dad said, no, you know, she couldn't come because she was advised by the attorney to leave the country as soon as possible. And so she left with the baby here with the grandfather. And the dad was working and taking care of the other kid as well. And the grandfather was trying his best to feed this little baby, who was not gaining weight, having constipation or diarrhea and all kinds of problems, because the grandpa had no clue as to how to make the formula. His hands were shaking as he was holding the baby, and that brought tears to our eyes. All of us staff were trying our best to just guide the grandfather on, you know, how to make the formula, because he couldn't even read the instructions, nor could he understand the ounces and the measures given on the formula can. So it was terrible. First of all, the baby was denied breast milk that the mom was feeding, and then it was having another problem being fed here. So I was afraid about both the mental health as the physical health of both the baby and the mom. And this child who needs the mom there for support, comfort, and feeding and everything, a citizen child, is being denied of that, you know. And what kind of a adult he is going to be with all this, these problems at such a young age.
Alia Haka is a nutrition services supervisor with the International Community Health Services. Sarah Sumati from One America, this draft proposal has been out for a while. What legal options are there to try to stop this change in policy?
So the draft proposal has been leaked for several months. Currently, it is in the Office of Management and Budget, where it's undergoing a regular review before it is posted to the Federal Register for public comment. This is actually one of the few opportunities that we have in the advocates community to make a real change. There have been rules proposed in the past that have been stopped by public comments. So there are a number of us nationwide here in Washington across all sectors, immigrant rights, health, nutrition, and we're getting ready to have a full-fledged assault during the public comment period to show the administration that this rule change is wrong and will have devastating effects. Again, we don't know when the rule will be published in the Federal Register. What we anticipate is a 60-day comment period. But yeah, we're ready to go.
Sarah Sumadi from One America, also with us, Alia Haq, Nutrition Services Supervisor with the International Community Health Services. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
They've been talking to us about a new rule in the works from the Trump administration that would authorize federal officials to deny legal permanent resident status, green cards, to legal immigrants if they've used public benefits, things like food stamps, Medicaid, or housing vouchers, benefits that they are entitled to. Aretha Franklin died Thursday in her home city of Detroit after battling pancreatic cancer. She was 76. Aretha's songs like Think and Respect were anthems of the civil rights and early feminist movement. Here's a deeper cut featuring one of her signature piano riffs. Don't play that song. Aretha Franklin passed away today. Former President Barack Obama said, every time she sang, we were all graced with a glimpse of the divine. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. It's The Record. Up ahead, Crazy Rich Asians. It's The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds, in for Bill Radke. The film Crazy Rich Asians premiered last night. Based on a 2013 book, it's the first Western-produced film with an exclusively Asian cast since the Joy Luck Club. That was 25 years ago. There's a hashtag Gold Open movement rooting for a huge box office success. Some individuals bought out entire theaters to give the general public a chance to see the film free of charge. One is Seattle resident David Chen, a marketer at Amazon and creator of podcasts and art. Chen bought a Saturday screening of the film at the Regal Cinemas downtown. He told the Seattle Times, as an Asian-American creator and aspiring filmmaker, representation on the big screen is something that's really important to me and that I'm really passionate about. With the opening, we have an opportunity to vote with our dollars about the kinds of films we want to see, end quote. So what's all the hubbub about? Crazy Rich Asians is a romantic comedy about Rachel Chu and Nick Young, who travel to Nick's home in Singapore to attend his best friend's wedding.
Singapore, for spring break. Colin's wedding. We've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. Come on. I'm Colin's best man. Don't you want to see where I grew up? Meet my family? My Amar, come to Singapore. I want the whole island to meet the brilliant Rachel.
Rachel Chu.
Once in Singapore, Rachel finds out that her boyfriend comes from a famous and extravagantly wealthy family, and that his mother is not particularly pleased to meet her. The all-Asian cast means that people have been putting a lot of importance on the film for representation in Hollywood and for Asian storylines. But are we putting too much weight on it? Are we expecting too much? We wanted to hear what some Seattle area residents thought of the film, so we invited them in to talk to us. Xiaoqing Chow is author of Chinese Soul Food. Naomi Ishisaka is a journalist, photographer, and former editor-in-chief of Colors Northwest Magazine. Annie Kuo is a journalist and public relations manager for the Seattle Asian American Film Festival. Annie, I understand you've already seen this film twice. Clearly, you were excited.
Yes, I am. And I'm about to pay for a ticket to see it again on Saturday.
Why? Why are you so excited about it?
About paying for a ticket?
No. About the film itself. I assume payment is part of your excitement. You'll actually pay.
It is actually part of why I'm excited to vote for more Hollywood movies with Asian themes. I'm voting with my movie ticket. But I'm excited about this film because it's been a long time that we've had since we haven't had a Hollywood major production featuring an all Asian American cast.
And you feel as though you buying a ticket and many people buying a ticket will mean that maybe there'll be one in less than 25 more years.
Absolutely. Yeah. I hope it'll be in a couple years. I hope it'll be within the year that people start working on another project. I want people to know that this opening weekend is actually significant when you go and pay for a movie like this, because it shows that Hollywood that there's an audience for this kind of story.
You said that it's a perfect storm that came together for this movie to happen. What's that mean?
Was that me or Naomi?
I thought it was you, but maybe not.
I might have told the producer this morning. Yeah, there are certain stars that were aligned for this movie to happen.
Yeah.
First of all, it's directed by an Asian American in Hollywood named John M. Chu. It's also being championed at Warner Brothers by the first Asian American director to head a major Hollywood studio, mm-hmm. Kevin Sugihara. And then the cast is incredible. It's full of shining stars, including Michelle Yeoh, who's a veteran actress. She was in Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And, you know, all of these things had to be aligned for this moment.
So it might be a culturally important movie, but Naomi, you wrote a piece for the Seattle Times and said, when you watched, my heart sank. Could you explain?
Yeah, I mean, I think like most Asian Americans, there really weren't very many depictions of us on screen when I was growing up or even in the past 25 years. And so when I finally saw something on a major movie release that was full of Asian Americans, it just couldn't be anything further from my life experience, the communities I was raised around, the communities I'm part of now, the world of the uber elite, rich Singaporean upper class, like the 0.0001%, just bears no resemblance to anything that I'm familiar with.
Well, one comment I've seen is that a more accurate or politically correct title for Crazy Rich Asians would be Crazy Rich Fair Asians or Crazy Rich East Asians.
Absolutely. And that was the other thing, which was pretty starkly apparent when you saw the film, that anyone that wasn't Chinese, Singaporean, or depicted as such was a servant or somehow the help serving the folks that were. And that's really problematic in a film like that to be seen across the world. And at the same time, it's really important, as I said later in the piece, that it doesn't have to bear the burden for representation for everyone.
But if this movie flops, does it mean we'll have to wait another 25 years for a film like this?
Right. And so that's the conundrum I think a lot of us are facing, which is that, you know, I want to see the film successful so that more films will be made. That said, you know, I hope that there's room for all different types of stories. There's a lot of work that's being done, not in the mainstream movie distribution system like on Netflix, that, you know, I've been watching Kim's Convenience, and it couldn't be more opposite of
Kim's crazy. Convenience. I'm not familiar with.
Oh, Kim's Convenience is this Canadian
TV series.
It's not a sitcom. It's more like it's just a comedy about a Korean Canadian family that runs a convenience store in Toronto. And it's centered around this very, very multicultural community in Toronto that is all immigrants from all different walks of Canadian life. And they all come together to sort of talk and about what's going on in their lives, and it really centers their experience and centers the fact that, you know, they have their own, they're like the, they're the people who would have been the quote unquote help in Crazy Rich Asians, and they have their own internal dreams and thoughts and things that they want to explore in their own lives, and that's completely absent in a film like Crazy Rich Asians.
Xiaoqing, this is, some people have said this is the Asian Black Panther, and really the reality of it is not as important as the fact that it was made. What's your take?
You know, I agree with a lot of what's been said about how, you know, on the one hand, yes, it's great representation, but on the other hand, it's fantasy. Like, you know, it's a piece of fiction, like most of the movies. And so at some level, I want to enjoy it strictly as a piece of entertainment. And as far as it's you know, the weight of having to be like Black Panther, I think that's a huge burden. You know, I don't know when they set out to adapt this book that was strictly the intention. Like, they wanted to bring this really great fun story to life, and I think that had they gone about it with the intention of saying, hey, we're going to create this thing and do it this way and make sure that, you know, we're represented, like, maybe it wouldn't have turned out so fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, it would have been something else entirely.
Xiaoqing, you're very interested in Asia through food.
Yes.
And how does this film represent food?
The part where they were at the hawker stand, I turned to my husband as we were watching. I said, that's for real. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, it's been a long time since I've been in Singapore, but that was one of the most significant memories.
And we should explain, like, hawker stands. I've actually been to hawker stands
in
Singapore.
You know, it's like a cafe court, but it's all street food. And the food is amazing. The seafood selections, seafood that you've never seen before. And then they cook it right there for you. So it's really fresh. And the flavors are intense because of just so many cultures that are mixed in Singapore. So you get to basically taste the world in a few bites.
Well, Michelle Yeoh, who is an actress in the film, she plays the wealthy mother of Nick Young. She spoke on the Today Show about Asian representation in films.
To be real representation means you have a meaningful character that has hopes and dreams. And in Crazy Rich Asians, that's what we all have. And it will be very impactful because it's a studio movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just an indie film.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
on
uh-huh.
TV.
I found that interesting. She said it's a studio movie because the backstory of this film is very interesting. Warner Brothers came in with an offer, and then Netflix came behind them, offering three films on Netflix, much more money and total artistic control, and yet they went with the movie. This is perhaps a comment about the larger culture, but does the fact that it's a real movie rather than something on Netflix give it more impact? What do you think?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Can I take this one? Yeah. I actually watched a interview that John M. Chu did, the director, about this very question, and I thought he made some really salient points. He said that the fact that this movie is in theaters, brick and mortar theaters where people have to get out of their house, drive, find parking, hopefully buy popcorn, that makes it very different from just sitting on their couch watching streaming movies, because actually movies that are streamed, there has been some movement of the needle there. But it's, you know, Hollywood, a Hollywood production. There's still a long ways to go. We've seen this with some of the stereotypes that perpetuate in Hollywood, with some of the whitewashing of Asian characters. Even just within the past few years, there have been several directors that have been called out for casting white actresses as characters of Asian descent, namely Cameron Crowe, who directed Aloha and cast Emma Stone as an Asian American, and then Rupert Sanders, who cast Scarlett Johansson in Ghost in the Shell as a character named Motoko Sugihara. Is it Sugihara? Very Japanese.
Are there storylines or incidents or jokes in Crazy Rich Asians when you were watching it, when you went to said to yourself, oh, I have not seen that before. This is just not something you see in regular movies.
Can I follow up on the earlier
question? Sure, absolutely.
Yeah, so I kind of think that I totally agree with Annie about the importance of having representation in major studio releases like this. It's hugely important for a host of reasons. And I think you kind of have to also think about it as trying to operate on multiple fronts. I really learned a lot from the thought leadership of Ava DuVernay, who was really, really groundbreaking in her belief that you don't just keep trying to get representation from folks who have repeatedly ignored you for decades and decades and the stories that you want to tell. You have to try to do it on multiple channels. And so she set up her own film festival releasing movement that allowed films to be shown by independent filmmakers of color on a wide release across the country. And then because they were on wide release, then they were eligible for film festivals, which is why you get a lot more recognition and can build your name. And that's really how she started. And it was through that multiple channel approach that got her into the major film studios and got her the credibility to be able to basically write her own ticket at Netflix, which is what she's doing now, yeah, to make Central Park 5. So it's like, it's not an either or. I think it's a both and strategy where you can do both and not just keep trying to knock on the same door and getting told no, trying to make your own doors.
You weren't a big fan, Naomi, but when you were watching it, were there some jokes where you just said, oh, this would not be in another movie or storylines or other incidents?
I mean, I'm with Xiaoqing. Like, that scene at the at the food court, I was like, where is the closest place that we can go after this
for chili crab
to get that exact same thing?
Answer, nowhere?
I don't know. What's the answer?
You have to buy a plane ticket to Singapore.
Oh, yeah, I don't want that answer.
How about you, Xiaoqing? You mentioned the food thing. Were there other aspects of the film where you went, oh, this is different?
Different or just resonated?
Resonated because you hadn't seen them in other films, and the fact that this was directed by an Asian American and about Asian Americans, was it something you wouldn't see in another film?
Certainly a lot of the storyline about kind of family relationships and filial love and responsibility to carry on the family business, the family name, and the Michelle Yeoh's character having to kind of give up her own aspirations for the good of the family, for the sake of the family, and that stuff, that rings so true in life. And and then at the end, I don't know if I want to give that away, but you know,
no spoilers.
But you know, the turnaround, the twist at the end, also resonated because these are, again, stories of love and sacrifice. And in my Asian experience, Chinese experience, sacrifice is a key word. You know, giving up everything that you know in order for a better life, or giving up everything that you know for the sake of someone else or the family or,
sure,
you know, whatever it is. And that, I definitely cried.
Annie, did that aspect of the film or others kind of jump out at you beyond the cultural significance where you went, oh, they really got it. They really nailed it.
Absolutely.
Like what?
I really enjoyed Ken Jeong, who's one of the comedic trio of the movie, making a joke about Cal State Fullerton, because I'm like, there's an Asian man on a Hollywood screen who is making a joke about, you know, a university, a public university here within our borders, you know, and it's like, this is an Asian American film. You know, I appreciated that reference.
In the beginning too, where they were saying, is that, how do you spell, was it Chu, the last name? And uh-huh. then they were talking about all the derivations of how you spell the last name Chu. That was pretty funny too.
Yeah. I watched this movie the second time with a theater packed full of Asian Americans last week in Houston at the Asian American Journalists Association annual meeting.
Oh.
And there was something very touching about being in a group that bonded culturally through some of the jokes we were hearing on screen. We recognized a lot of these characters and dynamics in our own families. So in some ways, I part a little bit with Naomi. I saw a lot of myself on screen, but I also have possibly different exposures too. I went to high school in Southeast Asia and have traveled multiple times to visit friends in Singapore who happen to be investment bankers. And so I have seen a little bit of that 1%. I'm not crazy rich, but maybe more like crazy and poor. But, you know, I identified with elements that appeared on screen.
It's just funny. When I went to Singapore, I was told that was Asian for beginners. I don't know if that's true or not. Stephanie Fu is a radio producer who saw the movie, and she said for her, it was more about entitlement than about money. She spoke on the Vox podcast Today Explained.
The rich people in that film are entitled, but also the main character, who is a normal Asian American daughter of a single mother immigrant, learns to possess that kind of entitlement, to be completely proud and forthcoming in who she is. And I think in a meta sense, the existence of the film does that as well. There's a space for us, and we are interesting and valid, and our stories have meaning.
It's a romantic comedy. Are we freighting this with too much cultural baggage to claim a larger significance for it? Thoughts?
Naomi? Maybe because there has been such a lack of this type of movie or art that suddenly all of the weight of everything has to sit upon it. So maybe that's an argument for more diverse films and art that have this type of representation. So then the weight is spread out amongst different arts versus just one film.
Naomi?
Yeah, I agree with that completely. And I also think that there is an incredible wealth of content that's being created that can be seen at film festivals, that can be seen online. And we need to do a better job, including myself, of supporting those films and those content creators as they are making that work as well, and really seeking them out and giving them our love, like the Asian American Film Festival. We need to be there and buying tickets and showing that support.
Naomi, you going to buy another ticket?
I am.
Xiaoqing, you going to buy another ticket?
Yeah, next time I get the chance.
Okay.
I'm not going to see it, but I'm going to buy a ticket.
I'm going to donate to the cause.
Xiaoqing Chow, author of Chinese Soul Food, Naomi Ishizaka, journalist, photographer, former editor-in-chief for Colors Northwest Magazine, and Annie Kuo, journalist and public relations manager for the Seattle Asian American Film Festival. Thanks so much for stopping by. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Ross.
Thank you.
And thanks for tuning into The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds in for Bill Radke. Tonight, the final live taping of Week in Review. It's at Carco Theater in Renton. Doors at 6, show at 6:30. Rachel Lerman, Monica Guzman, and Charles Mudede will discuss the week's events and much more. You'll see much more in the live show than you'll hear on the air. For tickets, go to kuow.org, search for Week in Review Tour. And if you miss the show, you can hear it tomorrow at noon on KUOW, Sound Stories, Sound Voices. Our program, produced by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jimma Brempong, Allison Bruzek, Sophie Reed, and Jason Pagano. Our social media producer, Bree Ripley. I'm Ross Reynolds. Have a great day.